Music Doodoo Classical Bedtime presents George Gershwin and the Rhythm of the Rails. Clickety-clack, clickety-clack. To most people on the midnight train to Boston, that's just the sound of heavy wheels grinding on iron. But for the young man in seat 24, something strange is happening. The rhythm is starting to grow. It's sprouting notes, growing a melody. The screech of the brakes becomes a wailing clarinet. The rumble of the engine becomes a thundering orchestra. Inside his head, the noise of the train is transforming into a wild blue song. His name is George Gershwin, and tonight, on this freezing train rattling through the darkness, he's about to hear something that will change music forever. Let me tell you how George Gershwin became the man on that train. He was born in Brooklyn, New York, in 1898. Back then, Brooklyn was loud. Horse carriages clattering over cobblestones, vendors hollering, "Fresh fish! Ripe tomatoes!" Children playing stickball in dusty alleyways. And music! Oh, the music! Ragtime pianos tinkling from saloons, bands playing on street corners, songs from a dozen different countries pouring out of apartment windows, Italian, Yiddish, Irish, all swirling together. George's family didn't have much money. His father was always starting new businesses, a restaurant one month, a bakery the next. They moved constantly. By the time George was 10, he'd lived in over 20 different apartments. But one day, something arrived that would change his life forever. A piano! A second-hand upright piano, delivered for his older brother Ira to learn. But here's what happened. The delivery men hauled that heavy piano up the stairs, grunting and sweating. They set it down in the cramped living room, and before Ira could even sit down, little George climbed onto the bench, put his small fingers on the keys, and started to play. He played a song he'd heard on the street. Just like that, no lessons, no practice. The notes were already inside him, waiting to come out. Everyone stared. Where had that come from? From that day on, the piano belonged to George. George didn't just play the piano, he wrestled with it. He played so fast and so hard that the upright practically shook on its legs, trying to keep up with the songs exploding out of his head. At 15, he got his first job in a place called Tin Pan Alley. Do you know what that was? Imagine a whole street in New York City filled with music publishers. Tiny offices crammed with pianos. And in each office, a young musician playing songs all day long, trying to convince people to buy the sheet music. George was a song plugger. That was his job title. He'd sit at a piano for 10 hours straight, playing the same songs over and over for anyone who walked in. But here's the secret. While everyone else played the songs exactly as written, George added his own touches. A little swoop here, a dreamy chord there. People started coming just to hear him play. He was learning to make melodies that floated right into your heart and stayed there.
Thank you.
how that melody just drifts into your heart. That's the magic George was discovering, how to write songs that felt like dreams. But in the 1920s, the serious music world wanted nothing to do with songs like that, or with jazz. Jazz is just noise, the important conductors sniffed. It's party music for dance halls, not art. They looked down their noses at jazz the way some people look at mud on their fancy shoes. But George heard something different. He heard the heartbeat of America, the sound of people from all over the world mixing together, creating something new, something alive. And one day, he got a chance to prove the snobs wrong. A famous band leader named Paul Whiteman called George with an impossible challenge. "I'm putting on a concert," he said. "A concert to prove that jazz is serious music, and I want you to write the most important piece." George said yes. Then Paul dropped the bombshell. "The concert is in 5 weeks."
"5 weeks to write a major concert piece. Most composers took years."
The days ticked by. 1 week, 2 weeks. George sat at his piano, staring at blank paper. His fingers touched the keys, but nothing came. Just silence. The notes felt lost, like they were wandering somewhere he couldn't reach. What if the snobs were right? What if jazz really was just noise? What if he was foolish to think the music of the streets could ever belong in a fancy concert hall? 3 weeks gone. George had to take a train from New York to Boston. He didn't feel like composing anymore. He just wanted to escape. He pressed his forehead against the cold window. The train picked up speed. Clickety-clack, clickety-clack. And then something happened. Like a door flying open in his mind, George heard it. The whole piece, complete and perfect. The rhythm of the train became the rhythm of America. The clatter of the wheels became dancing pianos. The shriek of the whistle became a wailing clarinet. By the time he reached Boston, George knew exactly what to write. He worked day and night. The notes poured out of him like water from a broken dam. He called his piece Rhapsody in Blue. Do you know what a rhapsody is? It's a very special kind of music. Think of a symphony like a canal. It stays between its walls and goes exactly where the map says. First movement here, second movement there. Everything neat and tidy. But a rhapsody is a river that floods its banks. It might chase a butterfly through a meadow, then suddenly plunge over a waterfall, then turn quiet and deep in a shadowy forest. It goes wherever its heart takes it. And the blue part? That came from jazz. Blue notes. The blues. That bittersweet feeling that makes your heart ache in the most wonderful way.
Now, I want you to listen for something very special at the beginning of this piece. You're going to hear a clarinet. That's a long black instrument that looks like a skinny tube with silver buttons. And this clarinet is going to do something crazy. Instead of playing separate notes, it's going to slide all the way up, like a piece of saltwater taffy being pulled and stretched until it almost snaps. Musicians call this a glissando. Here's a secret. George didn't actually write it that way. He wrote a simple scale. But at rehearsal, the clarinet player named Ross Gorman was goofing around. He played the notes as one long, smooth slide, like a cat stretching after a nap. Everyone laughed, but George's eyes went wide. "Keep that," he shouted. That's perfect! And so a joke became history. Listen for that slide. It's coming right now. Wasn't that glissando amazing? One of the most famous sounds in all of music, and it started as a joke. Now listen to the next part. The rhapsody keeps changing, like that river we talked about. One moment it's playful and bouncy, rushing through rapids. The next it slows down and becomes dreamy, almost like a lullaby floating through quiet waters. In this next section, listen for a melody that sounds like someone sighing happily on a warm afternoon. The piano will sing it first, and then the orchestra will pick it up, passing it around like friends sharing a beautiful secret. On February 12, 1924, Abraham Lincoln's birthday, Aeolian Hall in New York City was packed to bursting. Outside, snow fell silently on the city streets. Inside, the audience was getting restless. They'd already sat through 23 other pieces. People were yawning. Some were actually putting on their coats to leave. The critics sat with their arms folded,
ready to prove that jazz didn't belong in their precious concert hall. "This will be a disaster," one of them whispered. Then George walked out to the piano, 25 years old, wearing a simple black suit. The hall fell silent. The conductor raised his baton. The clarinet player lifted his instrument. And that slide, that magnificent, impossible slide, soared up into the air like a rocket. People sat up straight, jaws dropped. The music poured out, wild and tender, jazzy and grand, full of Brooklyn streets and American dreams. By the time George played the final crashing chord, the audience was on their feet, screaming with joy. The critics, who came to laugh, found themselves crying instead. The noise of the streets had found its way into the concert hall, and it was glorious. After Rhapsody in Blue made him famous, George travelled to Paris. Imagine it, 1928, the city of lights, painters and writers and musicians from all over the world sitting in sidewalk cafes, arguing about art, dreaming impossible dreams. George walked everywhere. He listened to everything. The accordion music floating from little bistros, the church bells, the clip-clop of horses on cobblestones, and especially the taxi horns. In those days, Parisian taxis had these wonderful, silly little horns that went ah-ooga in different pitches, each one different from the next. Most people would find taxi horns annoying, but George? George heard an orchestra. He actually bought 4 of those taxi horns and shipped them back to America. Real horns that real Parisian taxi drivers squeezed every day. Because George had a wild idea. What if the real sounds of the street could become part of a symphony? He wrote a brand new orchestral piece called An American in Paris. This music tells a story without any words. An American, maybe George himself, strolling through the streets of Paris on a sunny morning. Curious, excited, eyes wide with wonder. In this opening, listen for the walking. Those bouncy, cheerful notes are like happy footsteps on ancient cobblestones. And somewhere in there,
those real taxi horns honking away right in the middle of the orchestra. George wrote in the score exactly which taxi horns to use: A flat, B flat, D, and A. No made-up sounds. Real street noise turned into art. But being far from home isn't always easy. Even when you're having adventures in the most beautiful city in the world, sometimes you miss your own bed, your own street, the sounds you grew up with. In the middle of An American in Paris, the music slows way down. A lonely trumpet begins to sing a blues melody. Our American wanderer is sitting alone in a cafe now, stirring his coffee, gazing out the window. Paris is beautiful, but Brooklyn feels very far away. Listen for the moment when the trumpet sounds lonely, but also hopeful, because missing home means you have a home worth missing. And that's actually a beautiful thing. George Gershwin didn't live as long as he should have. In 1937, when he was only 38 years old, he became very sick. A tumour in his brain. There was nothing the doctors could do. Gave the world in those 38 years Broadway musicals that people still sing today. Porgy and Bess, one of the great American operas, and Rhapsody in Blue, the wild, beautiful piece that started as Clickety-Clack on a Midnight Train. George proved something important. He proved that music doesn't have to stay in boxes, that jazz can be serious, that the sounds of the street, taxi horns and train wheels and city noise, can become art. He proved that when you mix things together that don't belong together, sometimes you create something completely new, something the world has never heard before.
And you must laugh and sing and dance for two.
You know, every single day, somewhere in the world, Rhapsody in Blue is playing. In concert halls with crystal chandeliers, in living rooms where kids are practicing piano, on airplanes as they land in new cities, in movies and commercials and figure skating rinks. That music George heard on the train all those years ago, it's still travelling, still moving, still alive. The next time you hear the clickety-clack of a train, or the honk of a car horn, or the rhythm of rain drumming on your window, listen closely, really listen. There might be a rhapsody hiding in there, a wild blue song waiting for someone like you to hear it. sweet dreams.